Station. This episode is brought to you by the new Between the Lines books release, Palestine and Feminist Liberation. Coming up next. Launching in October 2024, news criticism podcast The North State features journalist Scott Martin punching through the noise bi-weekly and tackling how news media frames issues, emits information, and pushes the status quo. Like on this recent episode for news nerds, media freaks, and schadenfreude savants about the spectacular implosion of Canada Land and its infamous leader, Jesse Brown. Now, here's Scott.
The North State is a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. Hello everyone. Just before we get started today, I wanted to make a bit of an announcement. I realized the other day that we're nearing the end of 2025, which made me pause and have existential dread, but it also means that we're ending a year of the North State. So to celebrate, I want to do an episode where the focus is turned on me. Mostly when I hear other podcasts do this, the host gets the producer to come on and ask them questions. But with this show, I'm the host, producer, writer, editor, publisher, pretty much all of it. So I've enlisted the help of Eric Wickham. Alongside being Ontario reporter for Press Progress, he's also the producer for their podcast Sources, and he's a former producer for the podcast Tech Won't Save Us, and honestly plenty of other things. In other words, he's pretty much Canada's podcast producer. So to that end, I've asked Eric to come up with questions for me, but I also want to solicit them from you. In the show notes, I've included a link to a Google form so you can send your questions. They can be about the show, about Canadian news media, politics, whatever. Feel free to click through and submit your questions before December 12th. We got plenty of time for it. And you'll hear plenty of it from me. I'm going to bring it up every week, pretty much. Anyway, right after I promised every other week would be a monologue, I decided to have a panel about the 2025 budget. Glad I did, but shows how much my word is worth. This week, I thought I would expand some thoughts I had about something that happened in indie Canadian media recently. Something that I'm usually reluctant to talk about, and I'll get into that later, but it's Jesse Brown and Canada Land. For those who followed this podcast and The Catch for a while, you've seen me write about them a couple times. Indeed, the implosion of Canada Land was an important topic of conversation for some number of months. I'm not going to retread everything that's happened. I'll include a lot of articles by myself and other people about the phenomenon in the show notes, but I will try to summarize in a way that's somewhat succinct. Since the attacks by Hamas on October 7th, 2023, Canada Land founder and publisher Jesse Brown became far more vocal about what he deemed was anti-Semitism. Some of this was anti-Semitic, such as instances of Jewish schools being shot at, but a lot of this was not, or was very tenuous. He claimed protesters, for instance, that targeted Indigo were anti-Semitic because the CEO, Heather Reisman, was Jewish. And a demonstration that included postering and painting blood on windows of a store in Toronto happened on the anniversary of Kristallnacht. Kristallnacht was an infamous anti-Semitic pogrom in Nazi Germany that saw Nazi officials, the SS, the SA, and ordinary citizens destroy Jewish-owned businesses, burn down Jewish homes, and attack Jewish civilians. Almost 100 Jewish people were murdered, with suicides happening as well. Approximately 30,000 Jewish men were sent to concentration camps. Now, Heather Reisman was targeted because she also runs the Hesseg Foundation and pours millions of dollars into it. The foundation directly funds foreign recruits to the Israeli military, which has been conducting a genocide of Palestinian people for the past 3 years. Brown used the timing of this to argue that it was as bad as displaying a noose outside a business where black people worked. What else? Justin Lang and Paris Marks say that Brown edited out comments Marks made about Israel committing genocide. There's been a lot. Now, Brown has rejected Lang and Marks' accounts, framing it as a more typical editorial process. Those are just a few examples. Feel free to go through the links to learn more. In this span of time, Canada Land has also seen a mass exodus of reporters and contributors. Here's a list of some prominent names that have left. Justin Lang, Karen Pugliese, Archie Mann, Jordan Cornish, Jonathan Goldsby, Emily Nikolaos. Now, it's impossible to say the exact reasonings behind each of these people leaving, but such a high volume in a short amount of time is suspect, if nothing else, and publicly, it has been hinted towards. So why do I bring this up? Well, it's because Jesse Brown decided to release a promo for his latest podcast focused on anti-Semitism in Canada. From everyone in the industry, and outside it, that I've talked to, if anyone else did this podcast, they would be thrilled. But Canada Land, and more specifically, Jesse Brown, are the ones doing it. I wrote this past week in The Catch about the nitty-gritty details of this apology promo. I also don't want to retread all that, but long story short, Jesse doesn't accurately convey what parasocial means in an attempt to get his audience to identify with him more. Ironic. The podcast he's promoting already has possible holes in the analysis, with one salient Reddit thread asserting that he couldn't have come up with a figure cited in a different promo for the show. Now, I wrote the bulk of this piece before the series was released, but I won't be listening to it, for reasons that I will get into later. I did listen to the interview that Noor Azria conducted with Jesse on the Canada Land feed, and it reinforced a lot of what I'm about to bring up. First of all, it's titled Our Own Jewish Arab Peace Talk. The peace talks they're referencing are actually Israeli-Arab peace talks. So, you know, conflating Israel and Jewish. Again, I won't go through all of it. That's tedious. But at one point, Jesse talks about touch points in his Canadian life as a Jew and locations in Toronto that are important to him. He mentions, for example, that he was born at Mount Sinai Hospital. Then he goes on to say that every one of these locations was the target of an anti-Zionist protest or anti-Semitic attack. Unless there's a different event at Mount Sinai that he's referencing, he's probably referring to the protester in a Spider-Man costume that climbed scaffolding in front to wave a Palestinian flag in February 2024. Dave Gray Donald at The Grind wrote an excellent piece about what actually happened at that protest that got multiple politicians and voices to condemn it as anti-Semitism. But here's a snippet of what Gray Donald writes. There was no announcement made by organizers that the rally was stopping intentionally at Mount Sinai Hospital, and the crowd left the area within about 15 or 20 minutes of arriving there. This is about as long as the crowd stayed at other intersections. It was definitely a shorter stay than at the intersections where it had started and where it would end. The total duration of the rally was a bit over 3.5 hours. This Spider-Man character also repeatedly climbed things at other rallies. Noor said nothing to combat this. The rest of the interview is hard to listen to. I didn't have a good time. At one point, he goes against what he said in his supposed apology that I wrote about in The Catch, and posits, what if it isn't his fault that trust was broken? It was the listener. He asks himself, quote, were you responsible for the loss of trust, or is it on the receiver's side? He ascribes that with an example of somebody who said they weren't going to listen to him because he was a Jew talking about anti-Semitism. And another point, Jesse couldn't name any editors for his new podcast, despite asserting that he had some. You were asked multiple times. All right, so I've talked about some things that I don't want to talk about. So what the hell am I talking about? Well, that's the thing. I really, really don't want to talk about Jesse Brown or what's happened to Canada Land. I've written now 3 articles total, I think, about the situation that's developed over the past few years. I've tried to put my focus on systemic critiques in the news industry. You know, ideology, material pressures, the current state of the industry. But this one outlet. It's probably no surprise that I used to be a big fan of Canada Land. When I was in J school, I sent emails to Jesse trying to secure an internship there. I was a paid supporter for about a year or so. I listened regularly. It's the same old story. You know how it goes. Some people say, a lot was wrong, but a lot was good. I'm of that view. There were troubling signs, don't get me wrong. I usually point to Jesse's choice to invite Terry Glavin onto the show to defend his anti-Indigenous stance on residential schools, despite Indigenous outcry that this was a bad idea. I also halted my support for Canada Land after I listened to an episode about the plight of the humble landlord in the country. I couldn't get through it, but I knew I wanted to stop sending the money after Jesse said something along the lines of, quote, if you couldn't tell, I'm a landlord. I still can't find that episode, so if you know what I'm talking about, send it to me because I very vividly remember it. I never got a response about the internship, but I learned later that they didn't do unpaid internships, so maybe that was why. I don't really know. Either way, Canada Land held a special place in my heart. There's no way to know what extent the impact was, but obviously having a mandate of criticizing Canadian news deeply affected my trajectory. I can say pretty confidently, if regretfully, If there were no Canada Land, the Catch or the North State probably wouldn't exist. But that's not why I don't want to talk about Canada Land. It doesn't hurt me too much to cover it. It's not too painful to relive. If anything, I'd love to talk about what goes over there a lot more. But the reality is, it doesn't really do much of anything. Now, if there were people who worked at the company, or still do, who wanted to talk to me for a story, that's different. You know, that's original journalism. That's conducting interviews, reaching out for comments, reviewing emails, memos, what have you. But a lot of people just aren't talking. I don't blame them. This is a small industry, and honestly, unnecessary shit-flinging is just unproductive and probably not that satisfying. But don't get me wrong, if people want to talk, my email is youcaughtscott@gmail.com. I personally think it would be very important to chronicle not just what happened, but how something like this could happen. Right now, though, it doesn't seem like it's a possibility. So I'm going to give you my read on the situation with the publicly available knowledge we do have. Are you ready? Brown's influence grew and grew, overpowering most other personnel at the company. That's the long and short of it. But at this point, I think it's important to understand how that happened. See, Brown was always the only one in a position to truly tank the company's reputation. One of the great things Canada Land always did was its transparency reports. The one for 2023 is very telling. On page 14, it delves into ownership of the company. I'm gonna get a little number heavy here, but it's important for a point. As of January 2024, in total, there are 11,590 shares in Canada Land Inc. 1,008 shares are Class A preferred shares, held by the Tiny Foundation for an investment. 2,502 Class B common shares were held by several current and former employees and the developer of the original website. 8,000 Class A common shares were held by founder/publisher Jesse Brown. Class A common shares are the only type that carry voting privileges. That means that, functionally, Canada Land is the Jesse Brown network. Whether or not this should be the case is an argument I don't think anyone is really making. Whatever your views on business practices and news are, this is the reality. So it has always been Jesse Brown's project. Interestingly, I think it's important to note that these numbers are the same in the 2024 transparency report, because they're still from January of 2024. Weird. I would be interested in seeing up-to-date information about shares, but I suppose that transparency will have to wait until the next report. But the point is, I think whether or not you can trust Jesse's reporting, considering all the embarrassing behavior surrounding it, behavior, mind you, that still continues under a sheen of legitimacy, it's irrelevant. Materially, he is Canada Land. That's why I don't expect more from Noor interviewing him, or even her caveat that he doesn't have Final Cut on that interview. Because he's allegedly overstepped Final Cut before. He is undisputedly the sole decision-making actor at Canada Land. Put it this way. How many of you have looked your boss in the eye and told them everything they were doing wrong? Even if your boss, who controlled your income and your workplace conditions, said you could say whatever you want, when a lot of your coworkers have left because of their behavior. I'll be honest, I've been in that situation when I was in radio. I was given that opportunity, and I said, at the time, it's not worth it. So Jesse knows this dynamic, too, by the way. Noor, in the episode I listened to, repeatedly asked Jesse a variation of the question about his process. According to her, he spent near unlimited company time on it. Didn't tell anyone else, didn't have a process, didn't ask for internal reviews, and he came out with a 6-hour documentary without any further involvement from journalists at the company. She asks this, Noor, would you let me make a 6-hour doc for Canada Land the way that you just did? Jesse, no, you're too young, and you don't have your own media company. This was like the third time she asked, by the way. So Jesse knows how much power he has. He also knows the consequences of him acting without any checks and balances. He publicly and happily admits it. I mean, man, he laughed after giving that answer. Canada Land was the underdog in many ways. Say what you will about its initial funding or its flaws, it was an independent small newsroom that punched above its weight and had amazing talent under its wing. I'm not saying that Jesse Brown didn't have sole power over it then, but there was clearly more of a mitigating factor. That's gone. Now, I'm not saying that means it's in danger of collapse any day soon. Hell, Canada isn't exactly a big fan of exacting consequences on shitty news. But it does mean there's a vacuum for news media criticism in this country. It's one that I hope the North State fills. But that right there, I want to focus on that. That's the flip side of not wanting to talk about Canada Land. I don't want my work to be inextricably tied to the other place where news media criticism happens, or happened. There is no one way to do news media criticism. You can do it well, you can do it poorly, you can do it systemically, you can do it on an individual basis. One thing I want the North State to be is a cohesive look at the news industry as a whole. It's all tied together. The inherent bias entrenched in legacy outlets, the decline in revenue as a media, the polarization of coverage, it's all very similar.
There's a highlight from a recent episode of The North State. Find new episodes at host Scott Martin's thecatch.ca Substack and hear the rest of the conversation at harbingermedianetwork.com. This episode of Harbinger Showcase is brought to you by Palestinian scholar activist Nada Elia's new Between the Lines books release, Palestine and Feminist Liberation. And finally, Sierra Club Canada's The Environment in Canada is a weekly podcast exploring climate change, biodiversity, renewable energy, and democracy with hosts Jessica Murray in Toronto and Connor Curtis in Montreal. On this highlight from a recent episode, the team explain why LNG development, like the U.S. private equity-owned Casilisim's project in BC, isn't nation-building. Now, here's the show.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Environment in Canada podcast. I'm your host, Connor Curtis, and as you might have seen in breaking news, Mark Carney is due to announce another set of quote-unquote nation-building projects. As CBC News reported yesterday, November 11th, the federal government announced the first tranche in September, and being on the list is meant to help spur private investment and clear red tape for projects facing regulatory hurdles. Among the projects likely to be included in this new list of projects is the CSLSM's liquefied natural gas, or LNG, project in British Columbia. And so we thought it would be good to go over why these LNG projects proposed in Canada are not nation-building projects, in a number of different ways, including their connections to the US administration, their unpopularity relative to renewable energy, and the fact that they are economically irrelevant. And after talking about all of those reasons, we're going to chat about the negative health outcomes locally, like the fact that residents of Kitimat, BC, say LNG Canada's operations are already leaving them exhausted and worried for their health, as the Narwhal reported recently, and that there are already increased reports of respiratory problems linked to flaring as a plume of black smoke rises from LNG Canada. And we're going to go over the climate impact of these projects, since it must be noted that the federal government is choosing to back an unnecessary LNG project, that's liquefied natural gas project, even as COP30 happens in Brazil. So, for this special episode, here's why LNG projects are not nation-building, and why renewables are best for jobs, health, and the economy. As of June 2025, fewer than 1 in 5 Canadians want their tax dollars going to largely foreign-owned companies to build more LNG projects, and 72% of Albertans wish to maintain or increase federal climate action and action to transition the country to clean energy. In March, polling showed 65% of Canadians want renewables instead of oil and gas development, and polling in June confirms 67% now prefer renewables and clean energy generally to oil and gas development. It's 77% in BC. LNG Canada is actually a foreign-owned joint venture of Shell, Petronas, PetroChina, Mitsubishi Corporation, and Korea Gas. Meanwhile, other LNG projects are also backed by U.S. interests tied to the current U.S. administration. In BC, the CSLSM's LNG project is being incorrectly referred to by the Premier as Indigenous-owned, when the entity that will construct, own, and operate the assets of the project is a wholly owned subsidiary of Texas-based Western LNG, funded by U.S. private equity firms with ties to the U.S. administration. LNG is not a good solution for the Canadian economy and risks Canadians' health and our climate future. It's also not a good solution for local economies in BC, Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Atlantic Canada, and new gas plants are not needed locally either. So here's specifically why LNG is not a good plan for jobs or local economies. Global demand for oil and gas is set to peak this decade and then decline, and there are enough projects already underway to meet that demand. The policies and resulting impact of the current US administration will not change this fact. Plastics alone would never sustain the oil and gas industry in terms of anything close to current demand. Claims that gas demand will expand ignore the most recent research from the authoritative voice on energy, the International International Energy Agency. Forecasts that predict a shallow decline in oil and gas demand are based on unrealistic scenarios, and even a shallow decline spells trouble for global markets, as even a shallow decline can dump prices. Even Shell's CEO has warned of LNG oversupply as developers continue to approve additional projects, and Shell's CEO admitted it's not economically fully rational. Artificial intelligence is also not expected to change the case for LNG demand. As one energy analyst put it, we don't anticipate Germany needing gas for AI specifically, especially since heavier reliance on gas would just ramp up electricity prices and push these data centers away even more. As a result of the coming decline in demand, global oil and gas corporate exploration budgets are already shrinking, and oil and gas investment is shifting to short-term gains. Demand for liquefied natural gas or LNG in emerging markets is contingent on price, and LNG is expensive to produce in Canada. LNG is a risky bet, as renewables are rapidly becoming the default for energy development, especially across the global south. Low-cost renewable energy is soaring in China and Vietnam. Vietnam's wind and solar generation exceeds gas-fired power generation. Demand is estimated to have already peaked in Europe and South Korea. China has already surpassed its 2030 renewable energy ambitions. In fact, China installed more wind and solar power in a single year than the total amount of renewable energy currently operating in the United States. Canada actually risks losing out on the renewable future of energy and ending up reliant on China if we don't build our own independent renewable energy supply chains. And the International Energy Agency, again, the authoritative voice on energy, says in its World Energy Outlook for 2024 that it anticipates a surplus of LNG supply in coming years, and that we estimate that the sponsors of around 70% of LNG export projects currently under construction would struggle to recover their invested capital. Exporting LNG will likely raise the cost of gas in Canada, and BC households are going to experience much higher gas bills because BC has started exporting LNG, because they'll be paying global gas prices. This is despite, again, the fact that 77% of British Columbians favor renewable energy and clean energy products instead of LNG. In Australia, wholesale gas prices tripled as a result of this factor, and US households were paying 50% more for the gas as LNG exports began. By contrast, 81% of renewables offer cheaper energy than fossil fuels. Renewables also create far more jobs than oil and gas projects. It's easy to localize renewable jobs in communities in places like Alberta and Newfoundland and Labrador, where they are desperately needed, and northern BC. And renewables are more reliable than oil and gas. But all of this hasn't stopped the federal and provincial governments from wasting taxpayer money on dead-end LNG projects. LNG Canada received a precedent-setting incentive package, a policy framework from the BC government that includes corporate tax breaks, reduced rates for electricity consumption, and interest-free deferral of provincial sales tax on construction, each valued at tens of millions of dollars every year. It also received $275 million in direct federal subsidies and a federal exemption on steel tariffs, which cost taxpayers as much as $1 billion. Canada is spending three times more back in oil and gas than renewables, even though renewables are a better investment. The Nova Scotia provincial government has also attempted to implement a series of US-style authoritarian measures in favor of fracking for gas, and lifted a ban on fracking without consulting the Assembly of Nova Scotia Mi'kmaq Chiefs. It was a protection adopted after consultation and engagement with Nova Scotians and backed by health and economic research. The idea that we need new gas plants to enable renewable energy is also false. We already have energy storage options for renewable energy that are cheaper than building out new gas plants. Solar and wind with battery storage are said to produce cheaper electricity than natural gas in Alberta and Ontario. Many First Nations have spoken out against fracking and LNG development because infrastructure for these massive industrial projects such as pipelines crosses their territories. For example, the Wet'suwet'en never gave consent for the Coastal GasLink pipeline that was built to supply that LNG terminal in Kitimat, and several First Nations have not given consent to the Prince Rupert gas transmission that would supply the Slim's LNG project also in northern BC. LNG interests, as with all fossil fuel interests, now rely heavily on maintaining the false appearance that there will be continued oil and gas expansion, an appearance propped up by Canadian taxpayer support. Because if people see the evidence beyond a spin, investors will quickly realize reserves of oil and gas are overvalued. A key energy journalist wrote recently, "Every fossil fuel company everywhere wants investors, governments, and citizens to think, even against the thinnest of evidence, it will be the last one standing as its business case steadily crashes. But times are already tough, and the tell comes from two of the industry's biggest voices. The problem is that citizens, rather than fossil companies, and their shareholders might be stuck picking up the tab. In short, if Canada does not go renewable soon, we risk being left behind to carry the weight of a lot of very unpopular and uneconomical gas projects. Because renewables create more jobs and localized jobs while helping to protect the climate, it's also best to power any data centers with renewables, not gas. We already have renewable solutions for when the sun does not shine or wind does not blow, like interconnected grids, energy efficiency, and energy storage. But LNG prices are inherently volatile due to international factors beyond our control. And LNG harms our health. Already, as I mentioned, LNG exports are having negative health outcomes locally, with residents near LNG infrastructure reporting disturbing impacts. As Business in Vancouver reported, startup emissions at BC LNG plants are systemically underestimated, and some of the symptoms people are noticing in the area include nosebleeds, coughs, people having severe allergies. People are not sure what they're breathing in and not getting any answers about it. They're reporting things like a big black cloud of smoke, worsening symptoms, and increased reports of respiratory problems linked to flaring. And they're asking questions like, what is this going to look like in decades from now? And are things like incidence of cancer going to go through the roof? Again, there's some good reporting on this, not just because it's
There's an excerpt from a new episode of The Environment in Canada. Find it at sierraclub.ca and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You can listen to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. This episode's been brought to you by Palestinian scholar activist Nada Elia's new Between the Lines books release, Palestine and Feminist Liberation. Find it at btlbooks.com. And by Unrigged, learn more about Canada's coalition of more than 30 progressive publishers and get all your independent Canadian journalism, including news, videos, and podcasts, in one place at unrigged.ca. Follow us on Instagram and Blue Sky for updates on new episodes, and subscribe to the Harbinger newsletter for a weekly Wednesday roundup from Canada's cross-country community of 83 socially and politically progressive podcasts. We'll be back with a new episode next week. Until then, I'm Harbinger director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Now, back to your regularly scheduled community radio station programming.
Hi, this is Towers, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, BC. Diverse, independent, yours.
This is Bird Note. Masonville Cove in South Baltimore is a special place to study birds. Once a dumping ground for sediment dredged from the harbor, the cove is now a popular urban wildlife refuge, says ecologist Sharon Dorsey.
And we have seen a return of wildlife, not just mammals, foxes, otters, but a lot of bird species.
Sharon is part of a licensed research team that's monitoring bird populations at the cove with a scientific catch-and-release technique called bird banding. Sharon weighs and measures the captured birds, then fits each with a uniquely numbered metal band.
It's like a bracelet that they'll wear for the rest of their lives.
That info is recorded in a global database. So if the banded bird is encountered at another station, researchers will know that it spent part of its life in Baltimore. And that's important
because not many stations are set up in urban environments. We are essentially trying to describe what birds are doing in these urban spaces. You don't think that they would thrive, but in fact, they find food and mates and other things for their survival.
Sharon says that over time, this data can reveal which species take refuge at Masonville Cove and how habitat restoration benefits urban birds. This is Blackbirders Week. To learn more, follow the hashtag Blackbirders Week on social media and visit birdnote.org. I'm Dara Miles Wilson.